God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance today. Newcomers, is there anyone here today in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would just like to welcome you. Anybody? All right. Okay. And I have asked Brother Evan to read the preamble. Unmute yourself, bro.
I'm going to learn one of these months. Evan Calloway, alcoholic. This is our AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Thank you, Evan. Love you, brother.
Love you too.
Alrighty. So the format of this meeting is an open speaker ask it basket. Tonight we're very excited to have Tina A. from Los Angeles come to tell her story. After she speaks, we'll take a break around the top of the hour. We'll call for announcements, Path 7 Tradition Basket, give Tina a little break, and then we'll just reconvene after that for the final half hour of the meeting and ask questions that you submit. So please think of some questions, and you can chat them to the user questions at any time in the next hour, and Larry will gather those up, and then we'll reconvene and ask Tina some questions. So just really thrilled to have Tina come tonight, and I don't want to take up another minute of her time. I give you Tina A.
You could have taken up plenty of my minutes of my time. hi, guys. Tina Albert, alcoholic.
Hi, Tina.
Hey, David, thank you for asking me to come and be with you guys. I'm super grateful. Very grateful to be sober and to be here with you. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome if there's anybody new or relatively new that's in here with us tonight. What a weird format and weird time in our AA history this is. I actually got to go to my second in-person meeting since this whole COVID thing happened, and I live in Los Angeles, so I know there's like those, you know, secret, you got to know somebody kind of meetings. I would imagine the way that Alcoholics Anonymous used to be, like back in the 1930s, where you kind of got to go in the back door and have a secret handshake and be like, hey, Joe sent me, and then you get in. And so I went to one of those a couple of weeks ago. It was at this little place called Molly Malone's, which used to be like a Prohibition era speakeasy kind of bar. And the door was locked and I couldn't get in and they didn't answer the phone. I had to sneak around the back and it was all covert and cool. And I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And then last night, me and a couple people that I sponsor rolled over to Bakersfield. There was like 150 people in the meeting, and it was one of those hybrid meetings. Like, whoever thought that this would have been a topic of conversation, right? And then we read like the foreword to the fourth edition in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they write like in person or modem to modem, like this thing that's Alcoholics Anonymous can be transmitted. And I just love how seamlessly, with the help of so many different people, that we've just adapted to this new way of being, and that we're still able to reach new people and carry that life-saving, unadulterated message that is Alcoholics Anonymous. I love this thing, you guys. So I get to share with you in a general way, which I'm super grateful for, and you probably should be too, what I used to be like and what happened and what I'm trying to be like today. And I was a weird, odd, uncomfortable little kid, restless, irritable, and discontented from the time that I could remember. I think the moment that I was born, the doctor should have smacked my mom instead of me. There was just something wrong with me from the gate. And I was raised in this upper middle class little beach community in Southern California. I'm originally from West Virginia, from Wheeling, and my mom took off out of Wheeling when I was born, and she ran until she ran out of land. And we ended up all the way in Southern California at the beach, where Lake Venice is lovingly referred to as where the debris hits the sea. And I was kind of raised in that little area around a bunch of little girls that were like 5 feet tall, teeny tiny, petite, blonde, long blonde hair and sparkly blue eyes and pretty little surfer chick tans. They just looked like prepubescent Pamela Andersons. I mean, they were perfect. And I was 5'8" in the seventh grade. I had long stringy reddish hair, buck teeth, and freckles. And I would look at these little girls and see perfection. And then I would look in the mirror and I felt like Pippi Longstocking on crack. Just uncomfortable in my own skin, incapable of forming relationships with other people. If my best friend got a new friend, I felt like I had to beat up the new girl because I thought I was being replaced. Like, I would sit around the dinner table with my brothers and sisters and know that my mom loved them way more than she loved me. And I'm an only child. So there's that. Like, I'm not much. I'm just all that I think about. What I found out when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous is that I am consumed by self-centered fear that I'm not going to gain something that I demand or fail, or fear that I'm going to lose something that I possess. Like, I'm just completely consumed by me and what you think about me and how I show up in different situations. I can't see past my own nose, for crying out loud. And I was just this weird, freckle face, pasty little can't get a tan chick. I would go to the beach with my friends and they would lay out at the beach and I would slather baby oil and iodine all over myself and get these third degree burns, for crying out loud, with these big old blisters, and couldn't go to school because I had blisters all over myself and I couldn't bend my knees, for crying out loud. And a couple weeks later, when I'm starting to feel better, that thought would come into my head: but just won't put the iodine in the baby oil this time. Here's how it's going to work this time. It's going to be different, right? That alcoholic crazy thinking long before I ever picked up a drink. And when I was in the seventh grade, my best friend Carrie decided that we were going to cut school and go to her house and drink scotch. And I left my mom's house. I had nobody in my life that I could look at the effects that they got from a drink of alcohol and know that that might be a solution for this angst that just seemed to like hang over me. And I went to Carrie's house. I watched her take a pull off of that scotch bottle and her face got pink and she started giggling and she wasn't worried about getting in trouble because we were ditching school. And I took the scotch bottle from her and I was pretending like I know what I was doing, because you know how we do. And I took a big drink off that scotch bottle and it burned all the way down and it burned all the way back up. It burned when it came flying out my nose. It was vile. And I swore I wasn't going to drink any more of it. And then the thought came to me. I don't know where this came from. I just kind of made it up. That's how I roll in life. I just make stuff up and then that's the way that it is. But this thought came to me that if I didn't breathe while I was drinking the scotch, that it might not come back up out of my nose. And so I took a big old deep breath and I plugged my nose and I put that bottle back up to my lips and I chugged that scotch. And I was right, you guys. It did not burn until I inhaled. And then I felt like my whole body was on fire. But just enough of that scotch got down into my belly and stayed there that it did what my sponsor describes as altered my perception of reality. And all of a sudden, the world didn't seem like such a hostile place. You know what I mean? And I felt like I belonged for the first time in my life. Looking back at that first drink of scotch that I took, I think that I think that my hair straightened and my teeth shrunk and my boobs grew. That's what I think happened. In reality, what I know is that that self-centered fear that just seemed to consume me melted into the background. One of my sobriety sisters, Peg Martin, describes liquor, and she says it made her wittier, prettier, and tittier. And my goodness, you guys, I know what she means. I am a classic doctor's opinion in the big book girl. Like, I absolutely love the effect that I got from that drink of alcohol. And I had no idea that over the course of the next 8 years, you guys, I was going to be willing to trade absolutely everything that I loved in my life for another drink of alcohol. I had no idea that I used to want to be a dancer when I was a little girl, and I went to tap and jazz and ballet. I took acting lessons and voice lessons. Some of my friends were in the new Mickey Mouse Club when it came on television. And I took a drink of alcohol, and all of a sudden I thought my dance classes were lame and I just didn't want to do that anymore. And I gave up like dreams that I had for my future for another drink of Jack Daniel's whiskey. My goodness, I love the effect produced by that drink of liquor. And I can tell you in short order, just because the story's kind of funny. I love laughter in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think it's disarming. I think it's part of the music and a part of this language of the heart that we talk about. And so I took that drink of liquor that afternoon about noon. My mom came banging on the door because the school had called, and she realized that I was cutting school, and she came right to Carrie's house. Go figure. I don't know how she knew where I was, but there she is. She's banging on Carrie's door, and we jumped out Carrie's bedroom window, climbed over the backyard fence, and I was off on Pippi's first grand adventure. And I had so much fun that afternoon. We climbed the water tower in Manhattan Beach. We were jumping over backyard fences and hiding in your dog houses, and I was running from the cops, and they weren't even chasing me. Like, I had so much fun that afternoon. And about 4 o'clock that afternoon, I knew I couldn't go home, so I stole this bicycle from the continuation school. I took Carrie's 9-year-old brother and I put him on the handlebars of that stolen bicycle, and we ran away from home because it just seemed like the solution. And I am one of those girls who thinks up the solution, and it is far greater than the presenting problem in the first place. Like, I just blow things apart when I try to come up with my own solutions. And I remember I told that story to my first sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he told me, "Baby girl, they call that kidnapping." And I have hated sponsorship from that day to this, because they just come up with these lame-o ways of looking at stuff that just never quite occurs to me. But I pedaled Sean and I all the way up to East LA during this particular time in my 12 or 13-year-old development. I don't know about you guys, but I feel so weird on the inside that I dress up the outsides. Because if the insides are kind of normal and the outsides don't match up, like, it just doesn't reconcile, you know? So I would cut all my hair off and dye it obnoxious colors. And I would like do the Pippi Goes Punk phase. And I would go to school with safety pins in my ears, and I'd rip up all these designer clothes that my little single mom was buying me so I could look cool. And I'd run around with Iggy Pop album covers saying stupid stuff like "Anarchy in the UK" and "God Save the Queen." And then I would go home and listen to like Helen Reddy and John Denver, and I'd just cry, like, cause you know. And so when I was 12 or 13, I was doing the Pippi Goes Chola phase, and I ratted my hair up in this big Aquanet pitchfork and put on that black eyeliner, and I was wearing Dickies and Crips lips and running all over Redondo Beach scribbling La Flaca R13 all over the walls and pencil, because I'm quite the trendsetter. And I put Sean on the handlebars of the stolen bicycle. We ran away from home. I got all the way to East LA. And let me tell you, La Flaca did not fit in East LA. And I dumped that bicycle in the dumpster, and I called the cops on myself for the first and only time in my life, and they picked me up, and I can tell you that I devastated my mom that night. And it was not my intention when I cut school that morning and went to Carrie's house to drink scotch to kidnap her 9-year-old brother and run away from home and destroy my mom that evening, but that's what happens to me when I take a drink of liquor. I blow my life apart. I blow your life apart right along with me. I more than likely have large gaps in my memory, which you guys described to me as something called a blackout when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I make really boneheaded decisions. And then 8 years later, I come to Alcoholics Anonymous singing that AA theme song, like, it's my life. I should be able to do what I want. And truly, like, I don't really hurt other people when I drink. I hurt myself way more than I hurt you. But I tell you, you guys, when I take a drink of liquor, I splatter and I destroy everybody that's in a 30-yard radius of me. And I destroyed my poor mom that day and every single day up until the time that I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And unfortunately, for a long time after I got here, I was not the pinnacle of spirituality that you see sitting here before you this evening. Like, I was a nightmare in AA for a long time. I suppose I should tell you guys that my sobriety date is the 10th day of October in the year of our Lord 1984. And I'm 35 years sober, rolling up on 36, but really my sponsor would lovingly tell me, so that means you're 35. It's not October yet. But I can tell you that I had no idea that I was going to come into Alcoholics Anonymous and stay here with you guys. I just wanted a little break. And I came here at the ripe old age of 20. I followed some lame suggestions that had no bearing whatsoever to the problems happening in my life. And you guys have given me a brand new life. I am one that believes that alcohol saved my sanity long enough for me to come in here and allow you guys to save my life. And I am so incredibly grateful both for alcohol and alcoholism and Alcoholics Anonymous. I would not have it any other way. I wish I could have spared my mom some of the garbage that I put her through, but truthfully, like, I love my life today and who I get to be for the people in it. And it's a result of everything that I've gone through and me being here with you guys. I love that line in the big book that talks about my past is going to become my greatest asset, my dark past, because with that, I get to avert death and misery for other people. And what a great gift that we have in here. So now that I forgot where I was going and I took a sharp left, I suppose I should start all over again and tell you that my name's Tina and I'm an alcoholic. I'm kidding. But I drank myself into and out of middle school, MiraCosta High School, Pacific Shores Continuation School. And halfway through my sophomore year, I took the proficiency exam and I graduated from high school with a proficiency certificate. Because when you're a 16-year-old budding alcoholic, you can't let going to school stand in the way of the party. And so I never showed up. And I had 3 credits from a driver's ed class. And every now and then I would go to my choir class and my track class, but that was it. And I had no credits. I'm in continuation school. I take this little test and I passed with flying colors. I went to El Camino College and did the same thing that I did in high school, drunk and loaded before first period, leaving campus before I get in trouble, just a mess. I'm running away from home on a continuous basis because my mom wants me to do ridiculous things like come home at night, and I just can't, you know what I mean? Or I just won't is more like the truth. I just don't do what is expected of me. And when I was 17 years old, I got a little tired and I called my mom and she let me come home one more time. And I was working at Burger King in the drive-thru window, because that's what happens when you take the California High School Proficiency Certificate. You get to perfect phrases like, you want fries with that? And so I was working at this Burger King and I was drunk and loaded out the drive-thru window, and I turned around and there was a United States Marine standing at the cash register in his dress blue uniform. And I don't know about the rest of you ladies in here, maybe a couple of you gentlemen too, who knows, but I love a man in uniform. Started with Cub Scouts and then I like football players and sanitation workers. Like, I don't care. And I gave this guy my phone number, right? And he started calling me at crazy hours, like 10 o'clock in the morning. And it turned out that he was a United States Marine Corps recruiter. And so I went down to his office and I spun this really sad tale of woe about why I was 17 years old with a proficiency certificate. And he quickly figured out that he was not going to permit me into his United States Marine Corps. So he took me next door to the Navy office. And after a couple of tests and a couple of accidents, quite by accident, I can assure you, I ended up in Navy boot camp. I was the youngest kid in my company. I was drunk from the plane ride cross country. I had my first captain's mast. It's like court if you're a civilian, in boot camp. I got drunk in boot camp. Like, I don't know anybody else that got drunk in boot camp, but somebody brought me in a 6-pack of beer and I drank it and I almost got kicked out. and I was in so much trouble. Subsequently, that meant y'all were in so much trouble. So I had a lot of friends when I was in there. They would scream my name every single day, and then you guys would do push-ups. And everybody was mad at me all the time. And I graduated. I don't know how. They sent me to A school in Pensacola, Florida, where I was going to school to be a cryptologic technician, which means that I was enlisted to be in naval intelligence, which should frighten you guys a little bit. I love it when I tell that story in Canada, and I tell them, like, I think y'all are our allies, at least so far, right? but I was enlisted to be in naval intelligence. I was going to school. I had my second captain's mask for drinking on a duty weekend and leaving base when I wasn't supposed to. By this time, what it says in the big book that I've lost the power of choice and drink had become applicable in my life. And I drink seemingly against my own will when I don't want to, when I know that it's a really boneheaded idea and I have everything in my life that I love that I'm fixing to lose. I don't have the power of choice when it comes to a drink, and I drink anyway. And I met my second commanding officer. This time I lost a stripe and some money for a little while, and I spent 14 days in the restricted barracks, and I got set back into the class after mine, and I had my first encounter with Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was 17 years old, and I went to a couple of AA meetings, and I didn't relate with anything that you guys said. I was listening for all of the differences instead of the similarities. And they sent me to my first duty station, which was Adak, Alaska, only because I made somebody really mad. And so I'm stationed on this little Aleutian island off the Kamchatka Strait in Russia. And it was 1982. It was the middle of the Cold War era, or towards the end of the Cold War era. And we were spying on Russia. And that's where they send people in naval intelligence, and I'm secretary to the commanding officer of the naval security group on that island, and every piece of classified intelligence that we get from Russia comes across my desk, and I type it all up, and then I go have a couple Long Island iced teas on my lunch break, and I come back and start disseminating this classified information to the wrong people at the wrong commands. And the Navy frowns on that a little bit, just in case you weren't aware of that. I told that silly old sponsor that one too, and I didn't get the kidnapping thing. He got like, oh my God, baby girl, you were a threat to national security. I'm like, oh man, like, just stop it. And I'm just a nightmare, you guys. And they put me on Anabuse, and I drank on Anabuse. I got incredibly sick, and a couple weeks later I started thinking, because I'm a thinker, right? Like, I've been on Anabuse for weeks, and certainly my body's acclimated to it, and maybe if I had Coors Light, because that's almost water anyway, like, that's what you drink when you're not drinking is Coors Light, I would be able to have a drink on Anabuse. What my big book tells me is that I'm unable at certain times to bring into my consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago, and that I am without defense against that first drink. And I make the crazy decision, the insane decision, stark raving sober, to take a drink of alcohol, knowing precisely what's going to happen to me. Like, I might lie to myself and tell myself it's going to be different this time, but in my heart of hearts, I know precisely what's going to happen when I drink that beer. I'm going to get just as sick as I got the first time, right? And I go over to the EM club, and I think, like, maybe a shot of Jack Daniels just in case I puke. So I get the effect from the drink of alcohol, and I drink the whiskey and have a seizure and wake up in the emergency room of the Naval Hospital on that island. And in short order, I'm in the psychiatric unit in Anchorage, because the second time you drink on Anabuse, the Navy thinks it's grave emotional and mental disorders. And so I spent a couple weeks in the Elmendorf Air Force Base psychiatric unit, and they sent me back with a recommendation that I be discharged. And I was devastated. I begged Captain Shivik for another chance, and he sent me to a rehabilitation program in Philadelphia. I drank on Anabuse for the third time in that rehabilitation program and was kicked out of rehab and sent over to the naval station to wait for my separation. And I would have told you guys, like, no matter what, I swear on a stack of Bibles, hook me up to a lie detector, I'm going to not drink. I'm going to go to the neighborhood Alano Club in downtown Philadelphia, and I'm going to do whatever it takes to save my military career. And I meant it with every fiber of my being, you guys. And by noon, I was at the EM Club at the Naval Station in Philadelphia, pitching quarters and drinking beer on Anabuse one more time. Like I don't have what it takes to not pick up a drink by this time. And I was discharged from the military on the 15th day of July in 1983. It was the absolute worst day of my life. It was something that I never thought that I was going to be able to amend nor reconcile nor gain any kind of self-respect back as a result of my actions. I had just decimated everything that I love in my life. There's a line in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous that talks about alcoholism, and it says, with it goes the annihilation of all things worthwhile in life. And I looked that word up just to make sure that I understood like the full implication of what the Big Book was saying. And to annihilate means to reduce to nothing. And I can tell you guys that I reduced to nothing everything that I loved in my life behind a drink of Jack Daniel's whiskey. And unfortunately, I can tell you that a couple of times in sobriety, living my life according to self-will run riot, believing that I could wrest satisfaction out of this world if only I manage well, I've taken the reins back in my own life with multiple decades of sobriety and thought that I could run my own show, and I have annihilated everything worthwhile in my life in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And like what I know and the thing that I am the most grateful that I know is that I must be sponsored, that I must carry this message to other alcoholics, and that what I really have is only a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition, right? And most days my spiritual condition's all right in the midst of this pandemic or whatever you wanna call the nonsense that's happening in the world. Like sometimes I find myself restless, irritable, and discontented, unwilling to accept like the situation that I find myself in. And there's so much like stuff going on in my life. Like I think 2020 had some portal open up at the beginning of the year, and just all the evil in the universe is just poured upon us. And I'm sure going to be grateful when that damn portal closes, I got to tell you, because there's just stuff happening. And I am sponsored by someone who's not doing too awfully good right now. And sometimes I describe myself as an untethered sail, which is kind of dangerous, but I've got some other people that I'm talking to, and just, I love this thing that's AA. So I was discharged from the military in 1983. I was going to stay sober and go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I swore to my counselor when I was leaving the hospital, and I was 18 years old. You guys, it was like a month before my 19th birthday. And I told that counselor I was going to go to AA and I was going to do whatever it took to save my military career. And he looked at me with that look that so many people in my life have looked at me with, that disappointment and that misunderstanding, like, what is wrong with you? And he goes, that's good, kid. But if you ever really want to get sober, call Alcoholics Anonymous, but you won't, you'll die drunk. And I left the rehab and I drank for 15 more months, you guys, every single day, seemingly against my own will. I would get up and swear, today's the day I'm going to do the A&A thing, and I'm just not going to drink for one 24-hour period, because I'd been to your meetings and listened to your stuff, and I was going to try. And by 12 or 1 or 2 o'clock, like, the pain of being sober was just too great to bear, and I would drink again, and I wouldn't understand, like, why is it that I'm doing that? Dr. Silkworth, in the doctor's opinion, talks about us drinking, and what he says is that this is repeated over and over again, that unless I can experience an entire psychic change, there's very little hope of my recovery. And I didn't understand that on those days that I would wake up and think, like, just for one day, I'm going to try and do what you people tell me to do, and I don't understand why I can't do it. And on the 10th day of October in 1984, I was living in a two-seater MG Midget, a 1971 MG Midget, and I used to call it my roundabout townhouse, because when it would run, it would get me roundabout town, and when it didn't, I'd just park it somewhere and steal a big old bottle of vodka from the boys' market and put it in the den, and I would just sit in my car and drink, and I had no relationships left with anybody in my life. I had that acrid homeless stench that just takes months to wash out of your pores. Like, I used to steal soap and shampoo from the boys' market, and I would go down to the sand showers in Manhattan Beach and try and wash up. And the parents of my friends that I went to high school with would come riding down the bike path, and they would look at me with that look on their face, and like, that said, used to spend the night in my home with my daughter. Like, would you look at yourself? What happened to you? And I just look at the ground, and I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, like 120 sucked up pounds, dying of something called chronic active alcoholism. And I didn't know what that meant. I had hepatitis C. I was a super jaundiced, and I couldn't hold anything in my stomach because I take a drink of liquor and all bets are off. I'll do absolutely whatever it takes to escape reality once I take a drink. And you might tell me, want to put this dirty needle in your arm? And I'll tell you, sure, just go right ahead on and do that. And I'll do anything. Like, I don't care what it is. And the truth is, like, I introduce myself as an alcoholic because I have alcoholism, and booze was my go-to, man. Every other thing that I ever like got into over the course of my drinking and getting loaded came and went and whatever, but I never thought I would stop drinking. In A Vision for You, it talks about not being able to imagine a life with alcohol or without it, and knowing loneliness such as few people do, and being at that jumping off place. And on the 10th day of October in 1984, unbeknownst to me, I can assure you, I was at that jumping off place and I had no idea. And I just, like he was sitting in the seat next to me, I heard that little counselor tell me, if you ever want to get sober, kid. And I got out of the car and put a dime in the payphone, and I called Alcoholics Anonymous, and they sent me to you guys. They sent me all the way across town to the Southwest Alano Club in Hawthorne. I walked into a 5:30 Wednesday night meeting. The topic was relationships, which was perfect because I was looking for a couple. And I just sat down, you guys. I just sat down, and you were so incredibly kind to me. You brought me coffee a half a cup at a time because you knew in a minute I was going to start shaking and spill it all over the place. And you sat next to me. You took turns because I smelled really bad, but you sat next to me and you just rotated. And when the meeting was over, you guys gave me a big book, and it had 20 phone numbers of people that I was to call. But truthfully, I wouldn't call you to put me out if I was on fire. But I walked out of that meeting with your big book, and I went to leave, and this lady followed me out to the car, and she saw my vodka in the den, and she took it out of the car and she dumped it into the gutter, and like I was gonna whoop her backside, you know what I mean? And what she did was she just turned around and she walked me right back into the 8:30 meeting. She sat with me until the 8:30 meeting started. And then you guys took me to this fellowship thing at the coffee shop, and you trapped me in the middle of the booth where I couldn't get out. And you stayed with me until 2:01 a.m. and fed me coffee. And then when I couldn't get any more liquor, you disappeared like cockroaches when the lights come on. And I went and parked my car behind the Alano Club and just vibrated until 6 o'clock the next morning. And Gary came out. He was the secretary of the 6:45 attitude adjustment meeting. And he brought me a toothbrush and some soap, and he let me wash up in the bathroom and eat all the jelly donuts that I wanted before you guys got there for your little attitude adjustment meeting. And I just went to 4 meetings a day and the fellowship thing. And you guys told me to get a sponsor, and you told me the men work with the men and the women work with the women, and the men will pat your butt and the women will save it. So I asked this old guy named Paul Mattson to be my sponsor, because you know, and I thought I could work him for a tank of gas and some cigarettes, right? He put his size 11 straight up my butt, and it did not come out for 2 solid years. Like, he was a beast of a sponsor. And I would sit in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I would get up to the podium to share because I had lots of stuff to say. And he would stand up. I'd say, my name's Tina and I'm an alcoholic. And he'd stand up and go, that's all you know. Sit down now. And I would be like, what? And I remember I had 30 days sober and I was going to get up. He told me that I was to get up there and thank you for 30 days sober. So I was going to thank you for 30 days sober. And then I was going to give you the young people spin on alcoholism, because everybody at Birch was like 86 to 132. They all got sober before the crust of the earth cooled. You know what I mean? And I've been to psychiatrists and psychologists. I've been in rehabilitation programs on a psych unit in Anchorage. I've been to every single local city jail in the South Bay. I spent a little bit of time in LA County Jail, which I lovingly refer to as Sybil's Home for Wayward Women, but today it's Twin Towers. Like, I think I know some stuff about alcoholism that you guys clearly have not been informed about, and I was going to share some of it with you. And And I got up to the podium and I started talking, and he stood up and he was like, "You're finished now." And I was mortified, you guys. He humiliated me. And I like looked across the room at my old timers, like, "Are you guys going to let him be like that with me? You said you're going to love me until I could learn to love myself." And you guys were going, we clap in Los Angeles. And I swear to God, you guys, I was going to report you to New York. We're going to shut down the Alano Club. And like, I'm going to pull your sponsor licenses, because clearly you like missed a lesson or two. You're doing it all wrong. And I was so mad. I went in the kitchen. I was your coffee cup washer at that particular time in my sobriety with 30 days. And I washed the ashtrays first, and then I washed the ceramic cups and the dirty water, because I was going to show you. And like, I've done everything wrong that you could do in Alcoholics Anonymous. My first commitment was your ashtray putter outer person. And I would show up early and put two ashtrays equally from the ends of those long tables so that your osteoarthritic little arms could all hit the cigarettes with your ashtrays. And then I was your coffee cup washer, and then I pulled that nonsense. And like, you guys, just, you made me your greeter, and I would stand at the door and I was unable to make eye contact with you guys. And I love the Al-Anon women in my home group, because they would give me all their teenage daughters' clothing that was too offensive for their 13-year-old to wear. So I'd come in these mini skirts and these low cut shirts and these hooker heels with that 1980s flash dance hair going on, like, oh, something, you know. And I'm standing at the door and I'm your greeter. I can't look you in the eye because I feel just filthy, and I'm afraid you're gonna lick in my face and see like nobody's home, you know what I mean? So you come in, I don't want to hug you, I'm socking you in your little coumadin bruised arms, like, "Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous." And you guys would hobble over to the seat like, "Thanks, we're glad you're here, Tina." And Paul came into the meeting one time and he looked me up and down and he said, "Would you wear that to church?" And I was like, "Well, no, sir, but there's a dance after the meeting." He goes, "I'll be damned if you wear it to mine. Go change your clothing." And I was so angry. I've never had a man go tell me to put more clothes on in my whole life. Like, I didn't even know what to do with that. And I walked out to the trunk in the trunk of my car, and I pulled out some clothes and went to the bathroom and changed my clothes. I was so angry at him. And I had no idea, you guys, that by making me change my clothes, my sponsor was teaching me how to view myself a little bit differently than I had ever viewed myself before in my life. I didn't know that by changing the way that I dressed, he was teaching me how to carry myself with a little bit of grace and dignity, how to have a little bit of self-esteem and self-respect. He was showing that what I believed my value was had absolutely nothing to do with what my value was. And I didn't know that. And it wasn't a lesson that I came here to learn. And he wasn't one of those sponsors that I was permitted to ask questions about the stupid direction he was giving me. He just made me do the stuff. And I would go, like, "It says in the book that it's a suggestion." And he would tell me, "Baby girl, when it leaves my mouth, it's a suggestion. Once it hits your ears, it becomes a command, and you'll do as I say or I won't sponsor you." And I was like, "You are a jerk," right? He was this eclectic, funky, leftover hippie from the 60s with long gray hair. And he spoke with this Shakespearean English accent, even though he was from Inglewood, California. And we used to call him the orator, because he just had such a presence, and he spoke with this accent, and he'd get up to the podium and say, "Rarely have we seen a person fail." And I was like, yes. And like, he was just my dude. You know what I mean? Like, I know that it's a good idea for the men to work with the men and the women to work with the women. But what I really believe about this thing called sponsorship is that sometimes God just puts somebody right in your path that you're able to hear, that is a little bit louder than the noise in your head, that you're willing to accept advice and direction from without argument or question or debate. And I love that old man. I did the things that he told me to, not because I thought that I was going to have a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism. I just did the things that he asked me to because I wanted that silly old man to look at me one time and say, like, "I am proud of you, baby girl." And I can tell you that he did that over and over again for 2 years. And we went through the steps to the absolute best of his ability to take a broken little 20-year-old girl who had been through the things that I had been through and had the things done to me that I had had done to me. He did his absolute best to take me through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And on the 10th day of October in 1986, I walked up to the club to take my 2-year cake at the noon meeting. And you guys told me that my sponsor had passed away that morning. And I thought, excuse me, that I was going to have to leave Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't think that I could be here without him. He was my buffer and he was my rock and he was the first principled man that I felt completely safe with in my entire life. And I got another sponsor. It was a woman and she sponsored me for about half my sobriety. And she taught me so many things that Paul wasn't able to teach me. I had been, sexually assaulted when I was in the military, and I had some stuff happen to me that was super violent, and Paul didn't know how to take me through an inventory and do those kind of things. And so what he had me do is what I hear so often in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous when we're looking at the 4-step. He had me try and look for my part in column 4 in that inventory. And what I know today is that I tried to come up with my part because he wanted me to, and I wanted to do what he asked me to do. And today what I realize as a result of doing a lot more inventory and column work is that I didn't have a part in anything that those men did to me. What I did was I made some mistakes that placed myself in a position to be harmed. And when I can look at my mistakes and disregard the other person entirely, what it does is it takes me off the hook for the actions of another human being. And that was the greatest lesson that I could possibly learn from anyone in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it helped me grow into a woman of sometimes maybe a little bit of grace and dignity. And God, I love these lessons that we learn. And what I know is that they come whenever they come, right? There was this old timer that was around when I was new. His name was Singin' Sam. And he used to say, like, a bell ain't a bell till it's rung, and a song ain't a song till it's sung. And you can't hear until you can hear, and you can't see until you can see. And I know that every lesson that I learned from Paul in those first 2 years of sobriety was precisely what I needed to learn to carry me on to the next sponsor. And I love this thing that sponsorship. One of the things that Sam told me when I had a couple weeks sober and I had the gotta goes, I don't know if you guys had those when you were new, but I had them a lot. Like, he'd go, "How you doing, honey?" with that little voice that those old timer guys had. And I'd be like, "Sam, I gotta go." And he sat me down next to him one time and he goes, "You can hang tough for just one day, can't you, baby? Like, anybody can hang tough for just one day." And I sat down next to Sam in that 5:30 meeting, and somewhere about halfway through the meeting, as my problem du jour seemed to be melting into the background, what I realized was that I could not for the life of me imagine coming back tomorrow and telling Sam that I didn't hang tough for just one day. And I stayed. Like, that's my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous, that no matter how painful and how unfair and how horrific some of the things that life deals us in the midst of sobriety are, like, I can bite off anything in a 24-hour chunk and be able to swallow it and move on to the next day. You know what I mean? And I built an incredible life in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had kids and got married in that order, because that's what we used to do in the 1980s. And I built this incredible life. You guys, my goodness, I had 2 boys that I love more than life itself. And I had so many problems with this concept of a power greater than myself for the longest time in Alcoholics Anonymous. I love chapter 4 in our big book, We Agnostics, where Bill talks about those of us that are filled with failed self-reliance and fancied self-sufficiency. I don't know about you guys, but that's most assuredly me. And he says that we have these agnostic inclinations, and that's me. Like, the truth of the matter is, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and you guys talked about God, I would go like loud when you were at the podium, because I wanted to make sure you knew just how displeased I was with your topic of conversation. And I would suck my teeth and roll my eyes and get up and walk out, clippity clop over to the coffee bar, like, whatever. Just, I was so obnoxious. And what I believed when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous, what I would have told you, was that I didn't believe in God. And what I learned as a result of doing some old ideas inventories on a power greater than myself was that I didn't not believe in God. I have always had a fundamental idea of a power greater than myself. I'm a seeker. I have been for my entire life. But what I believed based on these old ideas and where I learned them from was that I had done things in my life and been places in my life that that would disallow me the privilege of having a relationship with a loving Father. And so why try anyway? It's just too late. And so it's much easier to say, just like, I don't want any of that nonsense, and make a quick left. And I did that for a long time in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was like the Tasmanian devil in my home group. Some of the old timers used to say, Jesus, little girl, I'm fixing to put you over my knee. Cause I was just such a nightmare. But you guys loved me in a way that I had never experienced in my whole life. And one day at a time, like that thing that happens in Alcoholics Anonymous happened to me as a result of being in your midst. And I moved up north. I married the Prince Charming in my fairy tale. He was just something, I got to tell you guys. And we were married for 17 and a half years. I woke up every morning and I felt like a princess in a fairy tale. And I'm raising these two little boys who I love more than life itself, you guys. And they're starting to do dumb stuff when they turn into teenagers. And I'm like, da-da-da-da, super mom, like, get out of the way. I'm fixing everything. And I will do anything for my boys. I love them so much. I will, not like financially, of course, but maybe a little bit, bail them out of any trouble that they get themselves into. I will fix anything that I can possibly fix. I will give them anything, do anything for them, make sure that they are loved and protected more than, like, oh my God, I love these kids so much. I would lay down my life for these boys. And I realized as the more boneheaded they got as they became teenagers, the more I realized, like, there is nothing that they could do that would make me not love them. Nothing. And I was listening to this cassette tape, I know, of this old cat named Chuck Chamberlain. And he said, I get up every day and I say, it's me, Dad, and I'm reporting for duty. And I thought, like, wait a minute, you guys have been talking to me about this power greater than myself, who is like understanding and love and forgiving and all of this silly nonsense. What if, like, God really is my Father and he loves me as completely and totally and protectively and unconditionally as I love my boys? And a little bit of my fight went away, you guys. And that's been my experience for 35 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, as long as I can open my mind just a tiny crack, like a little bit of my fight goes away. And I started to grow and develop in this relationship with a power greater than myself. And some days it's rocking, and some days I take the reins back and just roll my life right into Hades. You know what I mean? Cause I'm kind of good at that. But I've had like experience after experience that takes my breath away as a result of being in here with you guys. I gave my eldest born to the United States Navy because I am super creative when it comes to the ninth step amends process. And Matthew ended up in Iraq like that fast. And that was not the deal. Like, I gave him to the Navy because I wanted him on a boat. I didn't want him in Iraq. There's a method to my controlling, manipulative madness. Thank you very much. And he ended up in Iraq, and I was filled with this fear that I don't even know how to express to you guys. And my husband decided that the next step in his spiritual journey in Alcoholics Anonymous might be to prospect for the Hells Angels Motorcycle Club. And he rode off into the sunset with a bunch of greasy bikers who I thought were all male at the time. And I was mistaken, much to my dismay. And my marriage ended, and I was losing my house, and my kid was in Iraq, and my little guy started doing drugs and dropping out of high school and hanging out with these gangbangers, and like two parts of my story are coming to life before my very eyes. And my whole sober life when I was 21 years sober was circling the drain. And I was filled with this self-pity that I can't even describe to you guys. And when you're drowning in self-pity, you can't see what's going on, you know? And I would lay on my floor in the fetal position, just certain that in any given moment, my heart was going to stop. Like, it was this physical, visceral pain. And I didn't know what to do. And my girls were coming over and making me get dressed and feeding me, all the girls that I sponsored, and we're going to meetings. And I'm like doing everything that I know how to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm not getting any better. And about a year into this tsunami of self-pity, I was reading in step 11 in the 12 and 12. And it says that sometimes the hand of God is heavy and unjust. And it goes on to say that it's during these times that new lessons are learned and new resources of strength are uncovered. And it goes on to say that all of us at times, not just me, but all of us at times are seized with a rebellion so sickening that we simply refuse to pray. And I realized that I had lost faith in that power. And my experience, you guys, time and time and time again, over 35 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, is that I lose faith in that power. I'm not one of those people that you'll hear say from the podium that I don't believe that fear and faith can coexist. I absolutely do. I absolutely do. What I believe is that the faith is the thing that drives me through the fear. It's what allows me to continue to take action and move to the other side of it. And I can be scared to death right in the middle of it. And my experience has always been that on the far side, and only in retrospect, right? Like, I see God had his hand involved all the time. I heard somebody say the other day, it's one of those little sayings that I love, that the teacher is always silent during the test. You know what I mean? And I think the thing about life is that it gives us the test first, and then we get the lessons afterwards. It's not like a normal school kind of situation. And God, I love this thing. I love this thing. And I guess I'll talk for a couple minutes, because I have 8 minutes left, about the thing that seems to be happening to me in my life today. Is this whole idea, like the uncovering for me, seems to be about the idea of what is good and bad, and what is right and wrong, and what should happen and shouldn't happen, what's God's will and what's not God's will. And I always think that I know, you know what I mean? And like Matthew ended up in Iraq, and he came back from Iraq a much different young man than the one that I sent over there. He was physically whole, but mentally and emotionally and spiritually, he cracked while he was over there. And he came home with some post-traumatic stress disorder, and they sent him to a Navy rehabilitation program because he picked up a little drinking habit. And then when they kicked him out of the Navy, he spent 5 years homeless on the streets in Santa Barbara doing a little bit of recreational black tar heroin, trying to treat that post-traumatic stress. And my prayer every single day, you guys, for 5 years was, God, please don't make me bury my boy. Like, I've seen so many of you do it, and I know it's a possibility, but I don't know that I have that in me. You know what I mean? God, please, please don't make me do that. None of this, your will not mine be done. No, God, please don't make me do that. And what I can share with you is that the darkest times in his life and mine, when I was watching him circle the drain and believed every day that I was going to have to lose my baby, like last September, I got to give him a 5-year cake in Alcoholics Anonymous. And without him going to Iraq, and without him reaching the desperate bottom that he had to reach in order to come to us and surrender to his mom's AA, for crying out loud, that place I will never go, I will die first. Like, he had to scrape the bottom to become willing. And it is only through that horrific bottom, like, that he's been rocketed into this fourth dimension of existence that we get to experience in our midst. Time after time, that's been the case for me, you guys, with that husband that left me, and that self-pity that I found myself in, and the lack of relationships for so long in my life, because I grasped hold of an old idea, like, men leave anyway, why bother, right? Like, look, see, I told you, 17 years, whatever, but he's gone, and look what he did. Like, I'm right, damn it, I'm right. Like, I will hang on to my rightness, like, if it kills me. And what I realized later, like, we were driving to Bakersfield last night, and I was scrolling through Facebook because we were in the car, and Chris was on there having his little birthday party because today's his birthday. And oh my goodness, you guys, he was so drunk, so drunk, and he's a Hell's Angel, and he's married to this little gangbanger chick in Northern California, and she's a Sureño. That's a Mexican gang up there, and like his life, like, looks so incredibly unappealing to me. They appear to like it, but I realized, like, Chris leaving was the absolute kindest, most loving action that he could possibly take towards me. And when I was going through that, I couldn't have seen that. It's only in retrospect. I went to an esthetician and I had a funny little freckle on my chest, and it turned out that it was a little malignant melanoma. That's what happens when you do that baby oil iodine every day for 15 years, like, you get skin cancer. And I'm like, cancer, God, are you kidding me? That's horrible. Like, what are you talking about, cancer? And then as a result of that, we found some other stuff that I never would have known about had I not had that melanoma. Like, I'm in the midst of this thing with my mom right now. And I'm not one that talks about living amends, because I think my literature tells me that I'm supposed to make direct amends to the people that I've harmed. And I think the living amends, if there's such a real thing as that, is the second half of the 12th step that tells me, right, that I am to practice these principles in all of my affairs. And that kind of looks like a living amends, but I got some direct stuff to clean up before I can get there. And I have done my best to make direct amends to my mother and then be the daughter that she's deserved for a long time in Alcoholics Anonymous. It took 10 years for me to get a key back to her house, because I used to like to rob her and put my hands on my little 5'1" mother in an inappropriate fashion, to the point where she tells me that I'm to leave her house and never to come back, that her only child is dead. That's who I am when I'm drinking. And what I can tell you right now is that my mom seems to be slipping down this little dementia Alzheimer's slide. And some days it gets really gnarly. You know what I mean? And over the course of the last couple of weeks, my kids and I have made the decision that we're going to sell both of our houses and we're going to move back up to Northern California, where I came from. And I'm going to live with my mom. Yikes! That just makes me throw up in my mouth a little bit. But I'm gonna move in with my little mom, and you know what I'm gonna do? I'm gonna do my absolute best to make her laugh until she spits coffee out of her nose every single day for the rest of her life. Because what I get to do is be the daughter that she has deserved her whole life, that I've never been. And that is a result of the relationships that I have with you guys. And you guys teach me how to do those things that I don't think are a good idea and I don't want to. My friend Frank used to talk about being divinely inconvenienced. And I hope to be divinely inconvenienced by Alcoholics Anonymous and the people in my life for the rest of my life. I'm in a position right now where my sponsor's a little ill. He's 93. He fell and broke his hip, and he's having a really rough go. So if you guys are of the praying variety and you'd like to throw a couple prayers up for Clancy, I would most assuredly appreciate it. Goodness gracious, I love the life that I've been afforded as a result of being in your midst. I absolutely love Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know there's nobody new on here, but one of the things that I learned when I was brand new in here is that if I didn't take a drink for one 24-hour period at a time, and I kept hold of an old timer and I kept hold of a newcomer, I wouldn't have a hand free to pick up a drink. And I have an incredible life as a result of being here with you guys. If I live to be 100, I could never repay you for the life you've given me, but I promise I will spend every single day that I have left trying. So thank you for letting me share.
Thank you so much. That was amazing. I'm going to allow people to unmute themselves and thank Tina.
Thank you, Tina.
Tina, that was incredible. Thank you so much.
There's nothing more so much taking care of somebody that you love that is dying or sick. I've done it. And I wish I had your fire and your spirit. And I wish you lived next door to me. I think we would be best friends. You're awesome. You're so much fun.
Thank you.
And I have a daughter in the Navy.
Yay!
And my best friend has PTSD, so I get what you're saying.
All right, I'm going to take the meeting back for just a moment. We'll give Tina a break. And I'm going to pass the Seven Tradition basket. Seven Tradition states, oh, also, I'm going to remind everyone to please send your questions for Tina to the user questions, okay, in the chat. There's a user called questions. It's really Larry. Please send some questions. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the Seventh Tradition is essential. At every level of AA service, it is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their inner group, central office, local services, district, area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Our common welfare, a word about safety. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meeting can take place. I would be willing to take one or two AA announcements by show of blue hand. While you're doing that or not doing that, Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group or in need of a sponsor, please hang out after the meeting. Home group members, please raise your hands. KP, you got an announcement?
Yeah, I'm Vince Alcoholic. And Tina, thank you. I got sober in San Diego, and I only heard like the last 5 minutes of your share, but it had me just a little choked up. It was really good. That was awesome. Anyways, Wakefield Campfire Conference is the last full weekend in September. As of right now, it's still a go. You can find the registration forms online at wakefieldcampfireconference.org. And once again, it's the last full weekend of September. We'd love to have you guys be a part of. Thanks, Dave. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Vince. Tracy, you got an announcement?
Hi, this is JT. I'm an alcoholic.
JT.
Thank you, Tina. That was incredible. My home group, Candlelight, meeting is at 8 o'clock on Friday nights. The end of this month, we're having a workshop hosted with District 14, and the title of that workshop is Bill Wilson's Spiritual Journey, years 1955 to 1970. So if you're interested, the speaker is Jay Stinnett, and he should be speaking for about 30 minutes and then doing a Q&A somewhat very similar to this. So if you're interested, come see me, Dave Francis, Larry, anybody, see us after the meeting or ask questions between, and we'll try to get you some information. Thanks for letting me share.
Thanks, JT. All right. Sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, we will be available here after we close the meeting. Please stick around. You may have come in alone, but you do not have to leave that way. Or if you're shy, you can send an email to info@simpleactions.net. So once again, we've got a couple of questions stacking up. Please send your questions. And we'll bring Tina back. Now that I've composed myself, that was amazing, Tina. Thank you so much. Let's see. The first question from a member, I'm just going to read it. I haven't read these. Would you be willing to share more about what actions you took to move through your dark period in sobriety? Oh, you need to unmute, dear.
I said no. I'm kidding. I alluded to that little thing in the end of the 11th step in the 12 and 12. And what it says is that all of us at times are seized with a rebellion so sickening that we simply refuse to pray. The later part of that right after says that that we shouldn't think too harshly of ourselves when that happens and that we should just resume praying as soon as we're able. So obviously I think that that what gets me through that is a relationship with a power greater than myself and prayer and meditation. But until I can get to that time, like my experience when Chris left was that I spiraled for a long time and I ended up with a new sponsor. I was sponsored at the time by this old retired Marine Corps major in Northern California. I lived in Hollister, which was kind of Central Coast. And I used to go to my sponsor and I would be going absolutely crazy. And he would tell me, just pray about it, honey. Just pray for the best outcome for everybody involved, for you and Chris and those boys. You just keep praying. And my experience, you guys, was that I was praying until I was blue in the face and there was nothing happening. I was still full of self-pity and remorse and unwilling to admit like what was going on in my life. And I called Clancy. It was about 22 years sober. So it's coming up on 14 years ago. And I asked him to help me, which was the first brilliant thing that I had done in a long time. And what that means when I ask for help is that I'm willing to abandon myself to the will of another human being, that I am out of my own ideas, which is always a great thing. If I have one idea left, I won't ask anybody for help. And then the next thing that I did was I started following the directions that he gave me. The funny thing is, he didn't give me any direction that I wasn't already doing anyway. I was going to meetings and sponsoring other alcoholics and reading the book and trying to pray and meditate a little bit. But the difference is that I was following someone else's direction instead of my own. And I was accountable to another human being for the mess that I was making of my life. And the other thing that helped me more than just about anything is once I was ready to not make it Chris's fault anymore, I was able to take an inventory. And there's such power in that inventory. A lot of times I'll share just a little bit of that with you because we mistake the inventory process, right? And I used to think it was column one, who, column two, why, column three, what it affects, column four, what's my part. And the way that I did that inventory on Chris was, I think column two is Bill Wilson's drunk trap. I think it's what gets us to pick up the pen and go to town about what a rotten SOB you are. And I just do it up on those resentments because I got a lot of them and it looked like Chris. And I resent him because we lost our house and he cheated on me and he wasn't a good father to our children and he gave away our money and he put his hands on me in a way that a man shouldn't put their hands on a woman. And I just went to town on all of these things that he did that were wrong and what it affected. Goodness gracious, it just affected everything. And my self-esteem and my pocketbook and my pride and my personal and sex relations, like it affected absolutely everything. My standing in my AA community and how you guys view me, which is all about ego anyway, but I couldn't see that at the time. I just put down what it affected. And then what I learned how to do was turn the page over so that I wasn't looking at all the garbage on the front of the page because my big book tells me putting out of my mind the wrongs others have done. I resolutely look for my own mistakes. Where was I selfish, dishonest, and self-seeking and afraid? And so I turned the page over because I can't put out of my mind the wrongs others have done when I'm looking at them, for crying out loud. So I flipped that page over and I wrote down, in the 17 years that I was married to Chris, didn't have anything to do with any of that second column stuff. It's not where was I selfish and why did you cheat on me, or where was I dishonest and how come you like lost our house. Putting out of my mind what he did, where was I selfish? where did I play supermom and rob him of a relationship with his children because I had to be their everything? Where was I manipulative with our finances because I wanted to save money to buy a new house and he wanted a new motor in his motorcycle? Where did I hide bad motives beneath good ones because I wanted to make it look like I was doing the right thing? All of those are selfish and self-seeking motives. Where did I used to treat him like the Prince Charming in my fairy tale, and all of a sudden now the things he brings to me are stupid and I'm poo-pooing his ideas because they don't line up with what I think we want to do for our family? And I put all that stuff down on paper. Where did I manipulate him with sex or cut him off because he didn't do the right thing, or not cut him off because I wanted a new couch, or like whatever. Like I just wrote all that stuff down. And when I was done with that inventory and I read it, like, I understand why he cheated on me. Doesn't make it right, but I understand that I placed myself in that position. I started the ball rolling. My big book says, where did I step on the toes of my fellows and watch them retaliate? Like, I set all of this stuff in motion. Where did my own jealousy and my own insecurity and the actions that I took in relationship to that jealousy and insecurity drive him to do the things that he did? And where did he feel disrespected so that when he met those guys, he felt like that respect was now something he was getting that he wasn't getting from me anymore? And like everything started to make sense. And then, of course, what we do is we like look at the defects of character, ask God to remove those defects, and then we clean up our mess. And I called that man, and I didn't bring up any of that stuff. I told him I had a couple things to talk to him about, and he said, oh God, here we go again. Because I would call him up, and I'd be like, and so I go, I just need you to be quiet and listen to me for a minute. Well, really what I told him was I needed him to shut up and listen to me for a minute because I had some stuff to say. And he was like, oh Jesus, she's going to go off on me again. And I didn't tell him I was sorry. What I told him was that I was wrong, that I was selfish. This is where I was selfish. This is where I was dishonest. These are the things that I believe that I did that harmed you. And I have no idea how to make that right. Like, how can I make that right? When I tell you how I'm going to make it right, I'm playing God and you're in our relationship and I don't know. Like, I have a pretty good idea of the harms that I did, and what I need you to do is tell me how I can fix it. And I need you to tell me also what I missed, because there was some stuff that I missed. And he was more than willing to share it with me. And then when I was finished, what he said was, thank you for the call, Tina. And he hung up on me. And I thought, well, you, I'm going to cuss once, selfish bastard. Like, that was your perfect opportunity to tell me you were wrong when you blah. And he didn't give me none of that. None of that. Like, I used to go to bed every single night and dream about like nailing his door shut and setting his house on fire. I dreamt every single night about like when I pray, oh, like I pray you die. And he never burned up in a house fire. So I was relatively certain God wasn't listening. And like, it was just gnarly for a long time. And I made those amends. They didn't go the way I thought they were supposed to, but I can tell you that I went to bed that night and I slept like a baby for the first time in a year and a half. And what I know today is that when he had his stroke, because he's living the life and he's getting the consequences that come along with it, like I'm the one that called the hospital every day to check on him. His wife didn't do that. And that's fine. Like, that's none of my business. But what I learned how to do was respect the father of my children and call him on his birthday and call him on Father's Day and thank him for the participation in my life and the lives of our children. And what happens with those kids and him is none of my business anymore. And like, I find my answer always in the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I wish that I could pray and meditate stuff away, but what I find is that I have to take some sort of definitive action to clear away the garbage that blocks me off from the grace of God. Like Chuck Chamberlain used to talk about uncover, discover, and discard, and without that inventory process, I just rationalize and minimize all my own garbage and somehow or another make it your fault. I must do inventory and I must put it on paper or I can't see clearly.
Thank you. I got a two-parter here. Did you ever relapse? And if not, what do you tell sponsees that do?
So I had a couple pit stops in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't consider leaving AA and drinking again relapsing, because I was never like in Alcoholics Anonymous with the sponsor and taking the steps. I just was going to meetings at the request of the United States government. And so when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous on the 10th day of October in 1984, up until this point, I have not relapsed. But I didn't come in and stay the first time that I came here either. So make what you will of that. I am not somebody that's going to tell you that relapse is a part of recovery. That's like this hip thing to say in Los Angeles, like relapse is part of recovery. I don't believe it is. I don't believe that people that relapse are not in recovery. I believe that there's absolutely nothing that's wasted in God's economy. And when somebody drinks, it's really none of my business if that's what they want to do, right? What's my business is when they want to get sober, whether or not I'm willing and available to sponsor, to take somebody through the book or to work the steps with them. I don't think poorly of people that relapse. I sponsored this little girl named Patty, and she, she went out and she went out and she went out. Shari too, a bunch of them. Like I sponsored them for years and they just, could not or would not like see this way of life. And I don't know which one it is. I know the big book says some people are constitutionally incapable of being honest. And I know some people are constitutionally unwilling to be honest. And so it's not my judgment call. What I know is that people do what they need to do. And at some point, as it was for me, and as I'm sure it is for a lot of other people, like there's this moment of clarity, right? There's this moment when God comes in and it's that person's time with God to see things in a way that they maybe have never seen them before. And I don't judge people that drink again. I used to. I used to think you are right here in the middle of the answer and look at you drunk, like you must be doing something wrong. And I didn't get sober to do hard time. I was like so sanctimonious and full of myself. But the truth is, like Dr. Silkworth tells us in The Doctor's Opinion, that we're going to drink again if we don't experience an entire psychic change. And the way that we do that is we go through the steps. And so what I normally ask them is if they're willing to commit to a couple of 24 hours in a row of just waking up one morning and not taking a drink and going through the steps. And if they do that and they want to drink again, I'll buy them their first one. But I believe that the actions that we take like make it possible for us to live a lifetime of sobriety, a day at a time.
Awesome, thank you. What can a newcomer do in AA to increase their chances of obtaining sobriety?
God, you guys are playing stump the speaker, right? what can a newcomer do to increase their chances of sobriety? Like we tell you guys, like some old bleeding deacon, what I did, my chances of sobriety, that's what I'm supposed to share with you, my experience strength, and maybe it'll give you a little hope, is I went to a whole lot of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to 4 meetings every single day for the first like 18 months that I was sober. I took some suggestions from one of those sponsor thingies that I thought were preposterous. Like you guys told me don't get into a relationship for the first year. I did not find that in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, so I didn't listen to you. And what I learned was that relationships don't get you drunk in your first year of sobriety. They make you really thirsty sometimes, but they don't get you drunk, right? Like I did all kinds of boneheaded mistakes. One of the things that I think is the most powerful that I learned in my first year is that it is not the mistake that makes me drink. It's my need to defend it. And so if I can quickly, or sometimes not so quickly, admit and correct my faults and my mistakes, like then I'm able to move through them sober. So I got one of those sponsor thingies when I went like, Tim broke my heart. Paul went, go wash the coffee cups. And I was like, what does that have to do with the price of tea in China, for crying out loud? What? I said I'm in pain. And I just went and washed the coffee cups, like whatever, clean the bathrooms, do whatever. I just took really stupid actions that didn't make any sense and have no bearing whatsoever to the problems going on in my life. And I didn't drink. And I would suggest you surround yourself with the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, because sometimes when I'm incapable of taking the proper action, when self-will has cut me off from the grace of God and I'm going crazy in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I do that at 35 years sober. Sometimes I'm just nuts right in the middle of AA, like right now, like I'm just like, here's a good idea. Let's just sell both of our houses and go like there. And I don't even know what I'm doing, but I'm doing it anyway, because it just seems like the next indicated action. And I'm talking to some people about it. Like, surround yourself with some people that you trust and be transparent and tell them everything, every little thing that you think you want to keep a secret and not tell anybody because it's going to make you look bad. Just tell them anyway, and we'll have a really good laugh about it. And then it won't be a big dark secret anymore. Just do this stuff.
Right on. I wonder if you would share a little bit about what being a home group member has been like for you, the value of a home group. That's anything you want to share about being a home group member?
Yes. So my home group is the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, NM. And when the world reopens, every Wednesday at 7:30 at the University Synagogue in Brentwood, 800 of our closest friends are going to show up for a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so what I learned as a result of being a home group member is how to serve Alcoholics Anonymous, how to take my place right in your center, because that's my place and that's my seat. And I have a responsibility to the people in my home group, to the new guys that are going to come in behind me, and most assuredly to some of the heroes on whose shoulders I've been afforded the great opportunity to stand, to be there and to claim my seat and to make sure that the coffee is made. And like, it's so important to have a commitment, like even if it's a stupid, like gum scraping off of the concrete commitment at the synagogue, like what that has me do is, it makes me show up because I've got something to do, when my head tells me like I would much rather stay home and binge watch Game of Thrones or Handmaid's Tale or whatever. Like, I show up because I have a commitment at my home group. I have a place there. People know me. And when I don't show up, I get phone calls and I get to watch for people that I know that might not be showing up and wonder where they might be and make some phone calls myself. It just makes me a part of this big dysfunctional family that we belong to.
Right on. We have a question that says, you have an amazing sense of humor. Sometimes it's hard for me to laugh. How did you find the lighter side of your sobriety?
One of my friends told me one time that as soon as I learn to laugh at myself, I will never be left unamused. And that seems to be the truth. You know what? I find that I think laughter is part of the music that's Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't know if this come across or not, but I'm a little goofy. And I find that if I can make somebody laugh a little bit, it's disarming. And I can say things and they'll be able to hear me in a way that they might not be able to had they not been cracking up when I said them. And what I found is that absolutely nothing is really that serious, right? Like, if I truly believe that that everything happens precisely as it's supposed to in God's universe, like there's this funny kind of cosmic thing that underlies everything, and in it I find just a great amount of humor. Somebody told me one time that if you want to make God laugh, just tell him your plans. And my new understanding of a power greater than myself is that this father that I serve has a great sense of humor. Like, just look at my life and it's proof positive, right?
All right. Well, I don't know about you, Tina, but this has gone by in the blink of an eye. We've got one more question before we're out of time. And that is, what is your favorite passage in the Big Book currently and why?
I have so many. I don't know if you noticed that, but I'm kind of a fan of that Big Blue Book. Somebody tell me one time, like, Jesus, if we cut you, you just bleed blue. And what I found is that today I bleed like multiple shades of blue because I like the 12 and 12 also. So let's go with, and it might change halfway through. Oh my God, come on, brain. We suffer from the delusion that we could wrest satisfaction out of this world if only we manage well. I love that one because that's the way that, left to my own devices, I live my life. And if we break that down, right, to rest means to wrestle or to fight. Like, there's no flow in that. It's me like doing something. That I'm going to wrest satisfaction out of this world if only I manage well means that it's all up to me and what I do and how I make things happen in my own life. And the truth is that I do nothing but make messes when that happens. I love the one that talks about, I can't even think, you guys really put me on the spot. I hate that. When trouble comes, we cheerfully capitalize on it as an opportunity to let God show his omnipotence or whatever. I just slaughtered the quote, but that's just absolutely the way that my life seems to go. Like, I know that whatever happens in my life, if I don't drink and I continue to show up in Alcoholics Anonymous, God is so good. And I get to be just a little glimpse of that, hopefully for somebody sometime. And I'm really grateful for that. So that's all I got.
Ah, thank you so much. Just amazing. Thank you again, Tina. I'll thank everyone who participated, Larry, for wrangling the questions, etc. And I'll give everyone an opportunity to unmute after the Lord's Prayer. And I wonder if I could get BJ to read a vision for you.
Yeah, I'd love to. My name's BJ. I'm an alcoholic. And thank you so much, Tina. That was incredible. A vision for you, Big Book, page 164. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Thank you, BJ. Let's all circle up virtually and hold hands virtually and have a moment of silence to do with as you wish, followed by the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, But deliver us from evil.
From evil.
For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever.
Amen. Amen.